Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The legal battles over the statewide recount of Michigan's presidential election results have been raging. But at the same time, another story is clearly emerging, that of precincts that cannot be recounted because of Michigan's recount law, a law that harkens back to 1954. Mark Grebner is with Practical Political Consulting, based in East Lansing. He's a longtime political consultant, election observer in Michigan. He's also an incoming Ingham County commissioner, and he is a Democrat. Mark Grebner, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me on.
So in a nutshell, Michigan law says if the numbers on the seals recorded in the poll book election night don't match the number of ballots found today, that precinct isn't recountable. And if the number of ballots doesn't equal the number of names written in the poll book on election night, that precinct cannot be recounted. What do you make of Michigan's law?
All of Michigan election law is sort of an exploration in history. I think that the statute involved was recodified in 1954, but I think it actually dates to the 1870s. And this was a sensible way to run a recount back 150 years ago. You left out that if you transpose digits while writing down the number of the seal that clasps the ballot container together, then it's not recountable. Or if the seal that's used isn't of the right variety for the particular box you're using, you've used a seal taken from a different shelf, then it's not recountable. We have all sorts of rules like that, which assume that there are people in the courthouse at night stuffing extra ballots into the cracks of a ballot container.
Which possibly was a concern in the 1800s.
Right. It was a day long before security cameras, and every courthouse has huge old vaults which cost thousands and thousands of dollars 100 years ago, and which are now used for things like serving as a coffee station, since we don't actually have people breaking into courthouses anymore.
You have to ask yourself, if the numbers aren't matching, shouldn't that be a reason to count them?
You would think that. The result of Michigan law is that the worse that the precinct was run on election day, the more confused they were, the more ballots they lost track of, that is the precinct you can't count. But if the precinct was run perfectly, then you can recount them.
Yeah, the way you put that, if everything is copacetic, that's the ones you can count.
That's right. And again, just imagine a world where stuffing the ballot box was not just a vague idea. It was used because it was done routinely. It was a real threat that there would be people who would print up maybe a few hundred extra ballots and stuff them in. It's from the days before ballots were printed by the government. If you can imagine that each person brought a ballot to the election that he brought himself, right, and put it in front of the two election judges. It's just a different universe. But Michigan never gets around to fixing its law. And so all of our election laws date back to 100 or 150 years ago. So we end up with very inefficient elections.
So compare what we have to other states. How is it working elsewhere where they have gotten out of the 1800s?
Other states have other bizarre faults that Michigan has gotten past. So I don't want to make it sound like Michigan is alone in this. But it's just that this particular stupidity is a Michigan feature. So other states have realized that if they're off by one or two ballots, there needs to be some method for fixing that. And then you go ahead and recount the ballots. Michigan just didn't ever get around to fixing that particular aspect of its law.
So other states are more able to say, yeah, a tired worker who'd been on the job since 8 that morning and it's 11 at night maybe got a number wrong. So it's more able to account for worker errors?
Yes. The typical problem is actually something where somebody is voting, brings the ballot back out and says, I made a mistake. Can you give me a new ballot? Mm-hmm. So then they're issued a new ballot and the old one is struck off the list. But the question is, what do you do with the extra ballot and how do you get it to balance from then on? So now you've got one extra ballot and one fewer line in the poll book because you didn't sign the name in again. It's problems like that. And so they put it in an envelope, and they think they'll get to it later. And by 11 o'clock at night, when they're finally closing the precinct, they can't remember where they put that spoiled ballot. And that's when things fall apart.
What I think I'm hearing is when we have things like this happen, this is not a nefarious plot. This is often retirees who staff those precincts and who have been at it for long hours, and people are tired and people make mistakes.
Or to give you another example that's quite different but the same sort of innocent explanation, in Holt, apparently the people who were carrying the ballot containers around threw them into a storage area, and when they did, they cracked the seals, and three of the seals failed because the things were piled on top of each other. And so when they were brought out to be recounted, the seals were broken.
Mm.
Well, I guess that the janitor staff at Delhi Township Hall should be more careful. But, you know, nobody was trying to tamper with the election. They were just moving hundreds of pounds of ballots, and they were in a hurry.
So what, Mark Grebner, do you make of the Stein campaign's reason to do this recount, to make sure, as they say, that the integrity of the election wasn't compromised by hacking?
There's nothing in American law that requires political candidates to tell you what they're actually doing. We don't have any ability to question them under oath and prosecute them for lying to you. I think that was demonstrated by this last campaign. God only knows what the Stein campaign is really thinking or why they're doing this. I have no clue. I just find it really interesting because I'm getting precinct by precinct data of the accuracy of our vote counting system. And that's very interesting. So we're going to have maybe statewide data for every precinct, how accurately our equipment actually counts votes and what kinds of mistakes it makes.
What are you getting so far? What are you seeing as far as errors versus accuracy?
Michigan's vote counting system, which is due to be replaced, by the way, in the next 5 years, but our vote counting system is actually really bad. It makes errors in any given race in about 0.25% of all ballots. In other words, if you count 1,000 ballots, you're going to get 2 or 3 errors every precinct that has 1,000 ballots. We'll have 2 or 3 errors of some sort for any given race. And if you look at all the races on the ballot, maybe there are 30 different campaigns, that says that there's like a 10% chance that there's at least one mistake made in counting any given ballot. Well, if a bank ran at that rate, in other words, if you took in a $10,000 deposit and they were routinely off by $10 or $20 in crediting it to you, there'd be people fired in the bank. That just would be intolerable. If the 7-Eleven ran that sloppily and couldn't keep track of money that came in, all the clerks would be fired. But when we run elections, that kind of an error rate is just okay because I guess votes, you know, they don't really have to add up very well.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the vote counting equipment makes routine mistakes. And we just don't have a system set up to resolve those mistakes in real time. In the end, even if the Stein recount doesn't change the winner, which I'm almost sure it won't, they're going to discover that there were 10,000 or 15,000 miscounted ballots in Michigan. And that won't be a surprise.
So does the fact, Mark, that we've discovered this, does it make this recount effort worth it to be able to say, okay, here's where things are going wrong, we need to fix this?
Well, anybody who says this was worth it is somebody who's not paying for it. So I can say it's worth it. I mean, I'm not paying for it. Neither is the Stein campaign for most of it. I'm sure that the state government and the counties don't think it's worth it at all. But from the wreckage that occurs, at least I'm going to enjoy picking through the data because I'm a data guy. And I'm going to go and publish a couple of little papers about the kinds of errors we see and the statistical nature of those errors.
Well, how would you change Michigan's recount law?
Well, I think I'd try to change all of Michigan election law. It's not just the recounts that are creaky. It's the whole thing is sort of crazy. For example, if a ballot is in doubt, the machine that's doing the counting ought to provide an image of that ballot, not including the candidates' names. So in other words, just the marking around the arrow or the bubble, and have a couple of judges say that's a vote or that's not a vote, and do that at election time so that that's done. And the people making the judgment don't know who they're benefiting. And that way, you'd have all of these issues resolved in a way that was completely non-controversial long before election night was over. You notice that, for example, there are never recounts in Canada. And that's because Canadian elections are conducted by neutral bureaucrats, not by political officials.
It's going to be very interesting to, once you've digested all of this and put these papers together, to see what ideas you come up with. I have to say this, Mark. I know there are people avidly following this recount, and they are hoping that in some way the results will somehow upend the results of Election Day, meaning Donald Trump's election would not stand when the Electoral College meets December 19th. What do you say about those hopes?
Hope springs eternal. The election is over, but it'll make them feel better. I suppose these are also people who are looking forward to miracle cures for cancer. Good luck with that. I hope it works out, and more importantly, I hope it makes them feel better in the meantime. But I would say there's a chance in 1,000 that there will be some error discovered in Michigan sufficient to overturn the result.
Yeah.
But even if it did, it wouldn't make any difference because the other states' electoral votes give Trump a majority. So this election is over.
In the end, what should be the main takeaway from this messy recount process?
That Michigan law is out of date. The reason it's so out of date is that the legislature is paralyzed and only acts for partisan reasons. Nobody's interested in fixing this. the two parties are only interested in changing election law to get some other advantage. So you notice there have been changes to the election law proposed, but none of them have anything to do with fixing real problems. They have to do with things like requiring photo ID, because that will disadvantage Democrats. I just point out, by the way, that the state of Michigan already has photographs of very nearly every single voter. And if there were really an issue, for example, about who somebody is, why would you rely on an ID that they bring in? Why not print a photograph of each voter onto the poll list, a little thumbnail-sized one, so that when the voter comes in, the election worker looks up and says, you've gained a little weight.
But it's you.
But why would we rely on the voter to bring ID, except that there's some chance that some voters won't have ID? All of our changes to the election law have nothing to do with reforming it. They have to do with playing political football and trying to score a goal. So anyway, election law, and in particular the recount law, is not likely to be changed. Poor Chris Thomas, who does the very best he can, if he had much hair, he would be pulling it out. He has almost given up, I think, ever getting reforms, fundamental deep reforms to the election law. Because every time he proposes something, whatever he proposes is twisted until it benefits one party or the other, and then they try to ram it through. But they don't ever fix the problems that he really has day-to-day running elections.
Well, it certainly is quite an interesting political saga. Mark Grebner, longtime political consultant. Mark, thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, why we've got to do something about all the hours we spend sitting at our desks at work.
When you sit too long, those pathways that help us burn fat while we are inactive, they become inactive even more, to the point to where it increases our risk for obesity, type 2 diabetes.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This year marks the 40th anniversary of East Village Magazine, the little magazine that could. This nonprofit monthly magazine's been bringing community news to people in Flint since 1976, a labor of love for its founder, the late Gary Custer. East Village Magazine has hung in there to become one of the nation's oldest community media outlets. Here with us now is Jan Worth Nelson, who's the editor of East Village Magazine. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here. And we have Nick Custer, the managing editor. And if that name sounds familiar, yes, he is the nephew of founder Gary Custer. Welcome.
Thank you. Real pleasure.
Jan, how would you describe East Village Magazine to someone who's never seen it or read it?
It's very local, hyper-local, but it also has always had consciously a sort of a sense of style. We try to have very good writing in it. We try to do some literary things, personal essays, and you notice the beautiful covers. We're known for our covers. Nick's father, Ed, is our photographer, has been for 40 years.
And not many pages. So the idea is, rather than some big, thick thing stuffed with advertising, you're bringing writing.
Yeah,
right.
We really care about the written word. That really matters to us. I was a writing teacher at U of M Flint for 25 years, and I really, really, and I have an MFA in creative writing, so, and, you know, a background in journalism. So to me, the survival of the written word in a quality format is really, really important to me. But I wanted to mention that the photography part is also central to who we are. Gary was a photojournalism major at the University of Missouri, and he brought that journalism commitment to East Village Magazine for 40 years.
Well, Nick, tell us more about your uncle, Gary, and how did he come to found this magazine 40 years ago?
Well, it's really interesting.
We should mention, by the way, you were certainly not around.
Yeah, no, definitely not. But I grew up alongside the magazine, and it's been a really interesting experience. So we started it back in 1976 after coming back from, I believe, reporting in the Navy during Vietnam and doing a couple other things in Flint in the intervening years. And I think a lot of the impetus came from kind of this need for the community to have a voice and to have some more control over what was going on. The kind of central neighborhood that where he lived and a lot of the activities have taken place was part of the urban renewal. So about half the neighborhood was turned into Interstate 475. At the time, my understanding is a lot of the residents were very much against this, and it was kind of done from a top-down perspective. And so this was a way to regain control, to allow people locally to have these kind of AP journalism skills, which are very important, and to really just give Flint another outlet to speak its mind and to share information.
And Jan, what do you feel is the mission statement?
Well, we're there to inform the community about local matters, that maybe they wouldn't find out from anyone else. We're very committed to some things that might seem to be wonky, but that really affect people's lives, like what happens in the zoning boards and planning commissions sometimes. So we're there for the neighborhood. We're there to get news out for the neighborhood. Our overriding umbrella is called the Village Information Center. So we are hyper-local, trying to get the news out and also to do it with some flair, with really good writing, really good journalism, really good photography.
Nick, give us a sense of some of the topics.
We've done stuff from all sorts of perspectives on great community nonprofits exist and are doing work out there against school board matters, things from city council all the way down to neighborhood associations. We find that often, or at least I find, often some of the most functional organizations are actually at the neighborhood level and not in city governance.
Right, or there at the grassroots.
It's just a really important perspective, and you hear news and information that honestly you can't get anywhere else.
And the idea that it's coming out to people in Flint whose lives are directly impacted, this, how do you get this out to people? How are you distributing this?
That's, I think, the most fascinating part of it all, and maybe why it's only 8 to 12 pages at a month. It's all volunteer. So we have neighbors. They decide, I care about this. I want the information to get out there. I'll volunteer to do my block or my entire neighborhood. And that's really both a great advantage and slight disadvantage. You know, you only can reach as many people as are willing to distribute. But at the same time, people that are really committed. And we really do feel like a large family, like a real community that's making a difference in Flint.
Well, you do say heavily volunteer. I take it as they're being dropped off on people's mailboxes and doorsteps. Yeah. People aren't paying for this, so how do you keep the business going?
Well, we have advertising. We have some advertisers that I think there's two or three advertisers who've been with us for the whole 40 years. Mm. So, for instance, the Temple Dining Room is one of my favorite ones. It's a downtown institution at the Masonic Temple. So we have advertising. We make a pitch for donations, so our upcoming birthday party is a fundraiser.
Mm. Oh, and occasionally we get blessed with some grants. And so this run, we've been really lucky to have support from the C.S. Ma Foundation, which is also the organization that gave the first seed grant to start East Village 40 years ago.
What does community journalism mean to you, Nick?
I think community journalism is really being able to look at issues with a sense of empathy, with a sense of understanding and context that often you can't get when you have large media outlets coming into the community and just doing a quick overview. The water crisis is a great example.
And I certainly want us to talk about that. Right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. How did that community journalism approach inform the way you covered the Flint water crisis, Jan?
Well, because we're really deeply rooted in the community, we were experiencing it every day along with our readers. We're all the same neighbors. We all live next door to each other. So you're
brushing your teeth with a bottled water and worrying about water filters.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I write this back page column for EVM. I've been doing that for about 10 years or so. So I found myself responding personally to it, which was something that I could do with the format that we have. And that was very helpful to me. And I think it was a way to go beyond the shows and the hearings and the struggles of picking up water and everything. There was a personal voice that was able to be expressed in the magazine that wasn't seen in the same way anywhere else, I don't think. Also, Nick did some fabulous reporting. He wrote a story just about how to figure out if you had lead service lines coming into your house. Mm. And we had a little diagram that showed people how to do it.
Right.
And they didn't get that kind of help anywhere else. So we got like thousands of hits on that one article that was online and then appeared in the magazine itself. That's been a kind of coverage that I think is useful because we're coming at it from we live here and this
Absolutely.
Is what other people are saying.
Well, unlike most of the journalists who came in from around the world and focused on Flint, and that had to have been odd at the very least to see your town, you know, in the white hot spotlight of world attention.
Yeah, in a few ways, it was validating that the work we're doing is good and important and empowering of residents, especially stuff where we're able to give them the tools to make those decisions for themselves. At the same time, you know, it was also a little scary in ways because people will come in and they'll get it wrong consistently. And it's not necessarily their fault so much as it's such a complicated issue. Mm-hmm. And if you don't really have a local focus or a bit of context to understand what's really going on, you get lost in all the details. And so a lot of people will say, oh, it was Flint's officials that made this decision or it was solved now and it's this. And the reality is, you know, we're still dealing with the problems. Mm-hmm. And on the ground, it looks a lot different than the perceptions you get reading the articles.
Right.
So 40 years under your belt, what are your long-range goals for EVM?
Well, you know, we're kind of retro. It's a pickup magazine. It's not subscription. We're doing it as a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. We're depending on 50 distributors in rain and snow.
Volunteers. Family
yes,
involvement.
Yes, yes. And now our family has expanded. I would like to keep it going because I think Flint is just a fascinating place to be. Mm. And its story needs to be told at the level that we're able to tell it. And since none of us are like paid, we can be honest in a way that is very freeing and liberating. And I think that our city deserves to have that kind of attention.
And is that something I'm going to look at the next generation? Because you're the one that would take this into the future. Do you see this happening? Is this sustainable?
Sustainability is such a funny term, right?
It is.
You know, I'm along for the ride, and I have been for the last 12 years since I was 16 years old when I first started writing. I love the kind of stuff you can get out of East Village Magazine, the networks, the information you find that otherwise you wouldn't even ever know, and just the idea that what we're creating is something that doesn't exist in Flint. That one of the main focuses of the magazine is education. We teach people these styles. Mm-hmm. There's not currently journalism programs at all in the Flint area.
Right.
And so if you want to learn these skills, you either have to work for us or you might have to leave. And so we're giving people another reason to stay and love their community.
You can find the magazine at its website, eastvillagemagazine.org. I've been speaking with Chan Worth Nelson, the editor of East Village Magazine, and Nick Custer, the managing editor and the nephew of founder Gary Custer. Thanks to both of you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Real people, real conversations. That's what you hear all year long here on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You know, I spend my days thinking and talking about what matters on the show. Stateside brings you the stories that matter to you, to your neighbors. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Does this sound familiar? You get to work, grab your cup of coffee, turn on your computer, and then sit down to start the business of the day. And there you stay, sitting and sitting and sitting. For those of us with desk jobs, that is pretty much the drill through the work week. But more and more medical researchers are warning us all that sitting is wreaking havoc on our bodies. Dr. James Levine of the Mayo Clinic was the one who declared that sitting is the new smoking. Let's find out more now as we welcome Rebecca Hassan, who's an assistant professor at the University of Michigan Schools of Kinesiology and Public Health. Rebecca, it's so good to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm going to get it out right away. I have a real personal interest in what you're going to tell us because from 9 to 5, I am sitting. I have to write. I come in. I do interviews like this. I walk back and write some more. I come back. It is sitting. And then if I drive home, that's an hour at least, usually an hour and a half, hour 45, one way. And I can tell you after nearly 4 years, I am feeling it. So now I'm happy to have you tell me what's going on when we sit like this.
So there's a lot of different things going on when we sit too much. And most of the research over the last 50 years has focused a lot on exercise. So get up and for that 30 minutes, make sure you are on the treadmill. Make sure you're going for that brisk walk in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Make sure you're getting up and moving at a certain intensity for a certain amount of time that will help to reduce your risk for cardiovascular disease, help maintain a solid weight, help reduce your risk for cancer. So we know that exercise has all these wonderful benefits. But what we've noticed is a lot of the change that has occurred over the last 30 or 40 years hasn't really been in the recreational physical activity as much. If you look at the data, leisure time physical activity has stayed pretty much the same. About 1 in 5 people are meeting the physical activity recommendations. But what has happened, and we're seeing this happen in other countries as well, is that we have transitioned from more of a working on the job to sitting on the job. So the experiences that you have, the majority of Americans that have a desk or sedentary job are experiencing that same thing. So the recent literature has shown that it's not just sufficient. Yes, it's great to get exercise and to move at the appropriate intensity to reduce disease, but you are also, there's a different mechanism or different pathway by which sitting too much is also an independent risk factor, even if you're exercising.
So what's happening in the body when we're sitting at our desks from 9 to 5 every day, day in and day out? What's going on physiologically?
Physiologically, so there's a lot of research and most of the research is in animal literature because you can allow somebody to or an animal to sit for 8 or you'll immobilize maybe their hind limbs mm-hmm. for 8, 10, 12 hours.
You can come in and study me. Go ahead.
But we've seen what the literature has shown is that there are different enzymes related to fat metabolism. So how you were able to properly break down fat, those enzymes, it's called lipoprotein lipase, are inactivated as a function of sitting for a prolonged period of time. This usually happens around 6, 8, 12 hours. So the longer you sit, the longer the inactivation of those different enzymes. Mm-hmm. And then that will impact your glucose or fat metabolism in the body, which, again, it's different than exercising. We know that exercising does a great job in terms of helping us to burn fat, helping us to burn carbohydrate. But when you sit too long, those pathways that help us burn fat while we are inactive, they become inactive even more, to the point to where it increases our risk for obesity, type 2 diabetes. It increases our risk for cardiovascular disease. There's even been some literature that suggests that it increases mortality. And there's even, it's not consistent, but there's some studies that have even shown it increases your risk for certain cancers, obesity-related cancers.
That is quite a litany.
Yes, it is. So sitting is, so there. That's why a lot of the different literature, or we're seeing these comparisons with how sitting for too long is similar to smoking. If you think about it in terms of it's a modifiable behavior that we can change, it is something that is, it's easier to get up throughout the day than maybe it is even to exercise. And just moving is a first step in getting, transitioning people into exercising regularly.
How much moving should we be doing, especially when we're thinking we have deadlines, the boss needs that report? How much moving are we talking about?
So it's not a lot of movement. The United States currently does not have recommendations for how long we should be sitting. It says minimize our sitting. Canada does have recommendations. Canada says that every 2 hours we should get up and move. And even if it's just a small activity break, maybe 2 or 3 minutes to get the blood flowing, take the stairs up and down a little bit, maybe walk to go to the drinking fountain. Maybe instead of sending that email to the person across the room, there's a nice maze in here. So go to the front desk and have a conversation real quick. But it doesn't have to be where you are getting up every 30 minutes and doing 30 minutes of activity. If you get up once an hour, once every 2 hours, and get some movement, maybe 5 minutes. We are starting to do this in classrooms at schools, as well as you see it in the workplace. But we know particularly for learning, for children learning, that now, because PE and recess are starting to go away,
they are.
Because of different budget cuts or because of standardized tests, that structured physical activity is not as available, particularly for low-income or underperforming schools. And we know that a lot more time has been allocated to seated instructional time for students.
So now we're starting younger than ever as a nation of being a nation of sitters. And then, of course, what's happening? People are coming home, getting on computers, getting on video games, and watching TV.
Right. So as structured physical activity, or as structured movement, we call it, in adults, we call it occupational physical activity. So physical activity that you get on the job. In kids, we talk about it more in terms of free play, because kids are always moving. But in many cases, we are asking kids to sit for prolonged periods of time. Well, with technology increasing and how fun technology is for both kids and adults, we are also going home and accumulating, at least in children, between 6 and 8 hours of screen time a day, whether that's on a phone, a tablet, a computer, or the TV. So if you add it up throughout the day, we are sitting for potentially 10 to 12 hours a day. And so that 30 minutes of physical activity, it's good, but it will not counteract all of the sitting that we're doing.
Is it something that you might want to see managers make as kind of a policy? Hey, Bing, everybody get up and move around, or is that taking it too far?
Not at all. We would love to see policy. I would, as a scientist, you know, we need to do more research to see what is the exact dose. So when you are making policy changes, we usually try to give you a dose response or an actual prescription. How much movement do we need? When do they need to do it throughout the day that will give us an optimal result? So there is some more research that we need to do in order to actually hand that dose, because the managers don't have time to read through all of the scientific literature. Mm-hmm. But I do think that we are at a point to where we know prolonged periods of sitting is harmful to the body and to productivity. And so any amount of movement, even if we don't have that prescription just yet, any amount of movement will be good and should be enforced as a policy. And the amount of time that it will take away from actually sitting behind the computer will likely be brought back.
You get almost paid back from increased
productivity, yeah. Energy,
yes.
Good
attention.
Mood, attention, all of these different things that will help them be a better worker.
Interesting. Food for thought for everyone, everybody who's a desk jockey, whether you're a student, whether you're in an office. Rebecca Hassan is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan Schools of Kinesiology and Public Health. I will walk you to the door today. Thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, a different approach to investing in Detroit's neighborhoods, and it took a couple of outsiders to bring it.
We're not only interested in Detroit's real estate, we're interested in Detroit's history, and we're not just interested in Detroit's houses, we're interested in their people.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Talk about investment in Detroit, and the likes of Dan Gilbert or Christopher Illich might come to mind. Certainly, they've led the way, Dan Gilbert in particular, buying downtown buildings, reshaping the look of downtown Detroit. But we're going to look at investment in reshaping Detroit's neighborhoods. Andrew Colomb and David Alade moved to Detroit and launched an investment company they call Century Partners. Their idea: invest in Detroit's neighborhoods and close the wealth disparity gap by helping people invest in the rehabilitation of their own neighborhoods. So, pleasure to welcome Andrew Colomb and David Alade here to Stateside.
Hi, thank you so much, Cynthia. Yeah,
thank you.
Now, you both chose to give up jobs, pick up sticks, and come and move to Detroit. What were you each doing before you came here? What were you doing, Andrew?
I was living in Mississippi, and I had started a real estate company there. I started with five houses, and I built up that real estate portfolio to about 300 apartment units and 20 houses. So I felt like I was pretty strongly invested in Mississippi, and I felt good about that investment. I had a couple employees that worked for me. So I could kind of travel anywhere I wanted and sort of start fresh somewhere new, and Detroit was the place that I set my eyes on.
And we're going to talk about that in a moment. First, let's get the backstory, and David, tell us what you were doing and where you were.
Yeah, sure. So I'm from New York, born and raised, and I've never left, really, until moving to Detroit. I did investment banking for a number of years at two firms, Barclays and Credit Suisse, and primarily focused in the kind of asset finance world.
You, Andrew, decided Detroit was where you wanted to be, and why was that?
Believe it or not, it was because of a book I read. I'm one of those type of people that I actually do make decisions based off books. Sometimes for good, sometimes for not. But so this one was a good one. I read a book called Arc of Justice, which tells the history of the Great Migration in Detroit and the automobile industry. But it focuses all that through the story of a doctor named Dr. Ossian Sweet, who was a doctor in the Black Bottoms who moved to Detroit from Florida. And he made the American dream come true for himself, and he wanted to buy a house in a nice neighborhood, and he found a house in a white neighborhood, and the neighborhood wasn't accepting of him, and there was a lot of violence. And there was a lot of violence in America around housing at the time.
And we're going back quite a few decades.
Yeah, 1910, 1920s.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that book really inspired me. It made me want to move to Detroit and make that book into a movie and get involved in housing revitalization. And it started making me research Detroit more and pay more attention to Detroit. And so I started thinking about, if I want to do a business, it's never fun to do a business by yourself. So I'm like, who's the smartest guy I know of my generation that I could really think would be a good partner for this type of venture? So I'm hanging out with David in New York, and I started trying to pitch him on Detroit. And he literally ridiculed me, Cynthia.
I was worried about him. Man.
You laughed. No, you're like, what?
I thought the Mississippi sun had got to him over some time. I mean, it was real traumatic, I imagine, being down there. But, I actually cover the big three auto companies, so mm-hmm. Ford, GM, and Chrysler. So I was probably in Detroit or the Detroit metro area probably once a quarter for 6 years. And I think when I first started working, it's in 2009, and you had two of the big three auto companies were kind of in bankruptcy, emerging from, and another one, they were doing big capital raises to, prevent bankruptcy. So I did kind of come off because my professional career with a slightly negative conception of what was happening in Detroit. I knew it was a place that it was some sense of desperation, of definitely financial liquidity issues. And when Andrew came to me and talked about investing in Detroit, all I really had heard was, struggling auto companies, dilapidated housing, really bad crime. But I think about 2 years ago, I started, really thinking about, where I wanted my life to lead and, the things that I really cared about. And I thought about applying to B school. And during that process, they really forced you to think about what matters. And to me, I grew up in South Jamaica, Queens, went to school in Upper East Side, went to Columbia. I saw firsthand just huge, disparities in education, and health.
And income. Yes.
And for me, I think the source or one of the sources for those disparities across those fields is wealth. And if you look at how wealth is created in the U.S., it's primarily via home ownership, either owner-occupied homes or investment properties. And I thought Detroit would be an amazing place to you already had a ton of houses. You had a really strong percentage of home ownership, actually, relative to any top 20 city. Be an amazing place to actually help address that wealth disparity and do so on a profitable basis, where the folks who stuck with Detroit through the worst of times can actually fiscally and economically benefit from the resurgence that's happening here.
So when did you both come plant your roots here and say, all right, it is now time to put out our shingle, if you will, as Century Partners and start working?
I would count it in June of 2014 when we made our first trip together here.
And the bankruptcy was...
Yeah, we were definitely falling into bankruptcy,
yes.
The news. And he convinced me to start looking at it again. So we took a trip out here. We walked all these neighborhoods, Palmer Woods, Indian Village, Boston Eddy, Sherwood Forest. Fell in love with the city again. And the people. And they were as pleasant and friendly as people from the South, So... A lot of them are from the South,
Let's do it.
So I guess
tell me what it is, David, that Century Partners does that's different and unique.
I think there are a couple things. I think particularly, again, I'm from New York, and so when development happens in New York, it happens, in tandem with displacement. And that's because those communities are primarily renter communities. In Detroit, there's a unique opportunity because of the home percentage of home ownership, particularly in the neighborhoods that we're operating in. We have an ability to come into neighborhoods, do holistic, targeted investments, activate formerly vacant and blighted structures, and in so doing, develop and bring resources to a neighborhood without displacing the folks that are currently there. So in that way, I think in New York, a developer comes in, renters get displaced, and the developer caps all the upside. And here, the people who, again, stuck with Detroit, they're seeing their home values increase. And we've seen it just since we bought our first house in August 2014, home values increased dramatically. I think the second thing I think that makes us a bit unique is, part of our philosophy is really to kind of democratize access, to home ownership and real estate, not only in Detroit, but in other places as well. And we have an investment model and a fund that allows us to, two things, invite our friends and family, participate in our Detroit investment. So they can invest in our fund and gain, what we hope to be really strong returns. I think more interestingly is we have an avenue where current Detroiters, they can invest in our fund. They in exchange for some combination of, cash and equity, they can give us a house, maybe that was sitting next door to them that they bought for a couple hundred bucks from a tax foreclosure auction a couple years ago. And those folks will also benefit from the rise in appreciation we hope to deliver.
Which goes back to that goal to tackle the wealth disparity that
exists. Definitely.
Tell me what neighborhood you're focusing on. It's a big city, of acreage, huge city. So I'm sure you had to be strategic and smart.
Strategic, absolutely. So we really wanted to focus on a transition neighborhood, a neighborhood that we thought could either be a tipping point in a negative way or a tipping point in a positive way. So we focused our first investment on Atkinson Street, which is one block south of Boston Edison. So Boston Edison is a really strong anchor neighborhood, a lot of beautiful homes, really the first suburb in Detroit, probably one of the first suburbs in America. The houses were fairly stable. There was a lot of home ownership, and there wasn't that many vacant homes. But Atkinson Street was a little bit more dilapidated. There were more vacant homes. And we thought, all right, we want to go leverage the positive benefits of Boston Edison, but we want to invest really strong. We want to put a really strong investment in this one street. So we started with one house on that one street. Then we quickly expanded to five other homes. We have 15 units on just Atkinson Street. So I would say we sort of have an Atkinson Street investment, which is really close to Boston Edison. And then we also have the North End, which is on the other side of Woodward, where we have some multifamilies that we're invested in. That is a similar investment thesis in the sense that all the units are very close to one another. Mm-hmm. So I think in Detroit, you really have to be strategic because it's a very block-to-block city. Certain blocks are very dilapidated, a lot of crime, and other blocks are very safe and very stable. And we really want to use the city's investment in certain neighborhoods, in the natural investment in certain neighborhoods, to expand that footprint so that where there's a strong neighborhood in the periphery, there's another neighborhood that's getting stronger as well.
How have you been received by the neighbors where you're developing and where you're working?
Before we renovated a single home, we actually knocked on our neighbors' doors. So we went up and down Atkinson. We had a little survey we had printed out to really get to know our neighbors. You know, we learned a ton about them. I mean, we definitely thought there was a high degree of home ownership, but to actually see multiple people who had lived in the same home for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, mm-hmm. and they welcomed us. Many of them welcomed us into their home.
I think it helped that I lived in the neighborhood. So when I first moved here, mm-hmm. I moved into our first house. And I was fixing it up a little bit by myself, and then David said, this is going too slowly. We need to hire professionals. You're not a hipster. But it definitely helped that I moved here first, and I really got to know the neighbors. And there was a little bit of skepticism at first. I think the skepticism—
Developers, that connotation is not always a happy one for people.
Absolutely. Now, in the neighborhood, I think that the skepticism that I've seen in the neighborhoods around developers is really slumlords. Someone that's going to buy a house, because these are old historic homes, they're really expensive to fix up. So to get them properly fixed up, it's a costly expense. So I think there was some skepticism and some fear that we wouldn't really fix up the homes and that we would just throw a whole bunch of people in them, like throw 20 people into a huge home and not really fix it and like not really live in the neighborhood, not really see what type of damage that those people were doing to the neighborhood because we weren't there. It wasn't in our backyard. Once I think they saw us move in, they saw the quality of the renovations that we were putting in, and they saw the diligence and that we put in our screening process, because we really only want to rent to people who want to be in the Detroit neighborhoods, mm-hmm. who want to have a positive impact on Detroit's neighborhoods. So that, I think, gives us more credibility. And also, when people get to know you, they typically seem to, you know, people at this point, they know us in our areas. I mean, we're around, so.
Now, one of you tossed out kind of joking about the hipsters, but let me ask you this about your thoughts about the dynamics between the longtime black residents of neighborhoods and some of the new Detroiters who are coming in, who are often young, often white. I mean, that term hipster is kicked around. But what have you seen, and how do you see that working together for Detroit's neighborhoods?
I mean, I see it working together very well. And I think what they really care about is making sure that, you know, their neighborhoods are treated with respect. And I think that's what was able to help lend, you know, really strong credibility over time with our neighbors, for Andrew and I. Because we took the time to really bring really strong, you know, tenants and residents to the area. In our experience, you know, our neighbors didn't care if they're white, black, purple, yellow, as long as they're respecting the property. You know, they're not, you know, throwing loud parties. We're doing all the lawn maintenance and snow removal, and they're saying hello to their neighbors, and they're being respectful, and they're cleaning up after their dogs. I mean, that's really what people care about.
And if they don't, they know who to contact. I mean, the thing is, the neighbors have our phone numbers. So when they're unhappy with something, they let us know.
What do you both see as the key to a Detroit with economically healthy, active neighborhoods? There's been so much attention on downtown and midtown and Corktown. You're focusing attention on the neighborhood. So what would that look like? I'll let you take that one first, Andrew.
Okay. That's a really interesting question. I think that, one, you're definitely going to need a lot more commercial development in the neighborhoods. I think that's really part of the key to our success in the future will be our ability to have strong, original commercial enterprises. I think that the neighborhoods that are making really good comebacks, they have that in place. So I think we have the beautiful homes, so we don't have to worry. The matter of, you know, making those beautiful homes renovated and habitable again, that's just a financing thing that can be resolved really through numbers. I mean, that can be resolved. But you got to have commercial there, and I think you have to have really smart, engaged developers that look and feel to some degree, like the people in the community. Because I do think that there's a certain credibility that we have because we look like the people in the community. We can talk like them. We like the same music. To some degree, we can talk about sports the same. There's just an element of ease of communication that I think is going to be important to bridge the transition so that the neighborhoods are both diverse and inclusive, but also dynamic. And I think a lot of long-term Detroiters, black or white, realize that for a city to be dynamic, it has to have new people. I mean, a dynamic city accepts new people well, and it lets people leave well. So I think that Detroit is in a position to really accept lots of new people very well because naturally Detroiters are very friendly. So I think that you do have to respect Detroit. That's one thing I know. You have to come to Detroit with respect. And I think the fact that we read books about Detroit, we know about artists about Detroit, we know about the history of what they think about different politicians from different decades, we wonder and talk about it because we're not only interested in Detroit's real estate, we're interested in Detroit's history, and we're not just interested in Detroit's houses, we're interested in their people. So I think that that lends us an easy ability to sort of navigate that transition because we do need inclusive, diverse neighborhoods. You know, I think that is necessary, and I think Detroiters know that.
Where, David, do you see both of you in Century Partners, say, in 10 years, in 20 years? Where do you see your scope in the city?
That's a big question. That's a big question. We're taking it one day by day. but I'd say if I had to – you know, really, you know, take a stab at that. My dream would be really to create more Century Partners. You know, I love, you know, I think you mentioned earlier at the outset, you have the Dan Gilberts and the Illiches. You know, those are, when folks think about development, those are the faces that come to mind. And for me, I think what would mean a lot to me is to expand the scope for what a developer is. You know, I think also typically there's a negative connotation I found when it comes to development. You know, I think development really is, as a developer, that's a powerful role. To be able to kind of shape a community, shape, you know, potentially how folks interact and engage and kind of develop, you know, what makes a community attractive to people. That's a lot of power there. And I think if we can broaden the scope of folks who have, you know, ability to develop, you know, to be developers, we'll have better communities. We'll have strong communities. We'll have more diverse communities because I think you'll have a broader range of experiences that are woven into the fabric of what a community is. So I would love, for, you know, to help, maybe this help Andrew and I can help create a wave or facilitate a wave of more diverse, you know, developers to do thoughtful development in places that need it the most.
David Olade, Andrew Colom of Century Partners. Interesting approach to development. We want to thank you so much for being with us to share it.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. We really appreciate your time.
Today is the day that will live in infamy, in the words of President Franklin Roosevelt. This is the 75th anniversary of Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor, the attack that propelled the U.S. into World War II. The next year, some Hollywood heavyweights produced a propaganda film called Fellow Americans, designed to boost support for the war.
Fellow Americans, consider the skies of Michigan.
It was narrated by Jimmy Stewart, the first movie star to enter military service. At the time of this film, he was a second lieutenant in the Army Air Corps. And the film begins in Grand Rapids.
A few weeks ago, one ordinary Grand Rapids day, a bomb fell. Yes, here in Grand Rapids, a bomb fell on the furniture center of the USA. Someone was killed. Someone of Grand Rapids.
And that is true. That someone was Seaman Second Class Raymond Boynton. He was indeed from Grand Rapids and one of the more than 2,000 Americans who died in the Pearl Harbor attack. There will be a candlelight ceremony to mark this 75th anniversary at 6:30 this evening in Royal Oak at the Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial site at 13 Mile Road in Woodward. You can get all the details by going to michiganww2memorial.org, and that is the number 2. And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.